Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. We'll hear a debate on the topic, should affirmative action in Nebraska be banned? The ban is proposed as a constitutional amendment that voters will decide in the November 4th election. The proposal would bar public agencies, such as local governments, as well as the University of Nebraska, from considering race and gender when awarding scholarships, hiring employees, or contracting for construction work. The participants in the debate will be Ward Connerly, representing the Nebraska Civil Rights Initiative, and David Kramer, representing Nebraskans United. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, October 22, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Kerr, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Today we're asking the question, should there be an amendment to the Nebraska Constitution banning affirmative action in the state? The question will be on the Nebraska ballot November 4th. Here today in favor of the amendment is Ward Connerly. He is representing a group called Nebraska Civil Rights Initiative. Representing the opposition to the amendment is Omaha Attorney David Kramer, representing a group called Nebraskans United. Each of our guests will make a 15 to 20 minute presentation, after which we will have a question and answer session. Now there is paper and pencil, I hope, at your tables. Write down your questions and they will be brought to me to ask from the podium. So Mr. Connerly, we are going to begin with you.
It's a great pleasure to have the opportunity of visiting with you. Let the record show that I was invited to be here. I didn't descend from the clouds as an out-of-state interest here to foist my views upon you. There is one correction that I would make about the summary of the initiative. It is not an initiative to ban affirmative action. You will not see that on your ballot, because that is not what it would do. Affirmative action, as the courts have often ruled, is an amorphous term that means different things to different people. It might mean simply outreach, race-neutral outreach. It might mean efforts to review your job descriptions to ensure that they are not discriminatory in any way. And in some cases, it might mean goals and timetables that have the effect of being the functional equivalent of a quota. Affirmative action means many things. Precisely, however, the initiative that is before you this November is one that would, quote, prevent discrimination or preferential treatment against any individual or group on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin in the three areas of public employment, public education, or public contracting. You will wonder probably, well, why now? Race is always a contentious issue in our society. Whether you're in Nebraska, whether you're in California or Texas or Florida, wherever we are in this great country, race is always a contentious issue. Senator Obama is probably as close to being a candidate that wants to get beyond race as anyone you will ever see. And yet we are mired in a very, very tortuous debate about race in this campaign. So race is always a factor in our society, and I think that most Americans would like to get beyond it. In 1961, President John F. Kennedy said, "Race has no place in American life or law." And that quote establishes the framework for our society, I believe, to guide us in the direction of being blind to color, certainly in the public domain. And every February, as we celebrate the life and times of Martin Luther King Jr., we can all hear those memorable words about him dreaming of the day when his four little children will live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. That also reinforces the fact that we are, in fact, a people that strive for a colorblind government. 1964 Civil Rights Act that was signed by President Johnson and enacted by the Congress in the aftermath of the assassination of President Kennedy, that act, which is still the law of the land, proclaims that you and I and all of us
sex, or national origin. So we, in fact, do have a colorblind ethic in this country. We have strayed from that ethic on many occasions because the country has not always had a great history with regard to people who have the melanin quantum that I do, for example. And in straying from that, the courts have sanctioned it, sometimes holding their nose, as they did in 2003 when Sandra Day O'Connor allowed the use of race as one of many factors in the pursuit of diversity in the university setting. But she went on to say that this is something that the Constitution barely tolerates. And she also noted that there were many states that were moving in the direction of adopting race-neutral measures. California is among them. California has adopted had on its books for about 12 years an initiative that forbids government, state, local, special districts, universities, from treating people differently on the basis of those factors that I mentioned to you, race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin. Passed 55 to 45. State of Washington adopted an identical measure, 59 to 41. The state of Michigan, 58 to 42. And these are all some of the bluest of blue states in our country. So one should not believe that this is some radical notion that is being foisted upon you. I have been invited to this state for about 10 years by the Nebraska Association of Scholars, individuals who had encountered the use of race in the university setting to try to help them to get an initiative on the ballot and to get it passed. Until now, time has not permitted me to help them. But the issue is there before you. I'm not on the ballot. I didn't sign any petitions. The issue is before you, and it begs the question of whether any government entity in the state of Nebraska should treat its citizens, any of its citizens, differently on the basis of race. You will often hear those who say, well, it's a good idea, it's a very noble idea, but are we there yet? Is the time appropriate to do this? I would submit that there has never been a more appropriate time for us to cast aside the issue of race than probably now. We have a man who is poised to become the president of our nation who is biracial, and that in and of itself is a story about our country, because there was a time when his parents could not have married in our nation. But whether or not you support or you oppose Senator Obama, clearly his unparalleled success signals that our country has changed profoundly, has changed fundamentally, and Governor Palin is also a reflection of that change. So the argument that we need these programs of preferences, call them affirmative action if you will, in order to level the playing field because our society is institutionally racist or institutionally sexist, that argument does not hold water, my friends, because our society has changed. This isn't to suggest that all racism or sexism has ended. It has not. It isn't to suggest that we do not need to concern ourselves with the plight of our fellow citizens. We certainly should. But I think that the paradigm of affirmative action, as we have called it, has outlived its usefulness. It is time now for us to look at students, low-income kids in low-income neighborhoods who are not getting a good education, and to help prepare them so that they can compete on their own for college admission. And most colleges that I know of desperately want them. We need to make sure that we provide early childhood education, which I think is more important than, in many cases, than a year or two of college. When I was a regent at the University of California, I once said in a budget meeting of the finance committee that I chaired that I would much prefer to sacrifice a year's budget at the university if we could inaugurate early childhood education. That did not go over very well with the president and some of the chancellors. But I think it's vastly important that we do a better job of preparing our kids, all of our kids, so that they can compete in the global environment. I also think that after-school programs are important.
And often you will find in the states that where this is passed, there is an arousal on the part of the elected officials to do more, to do things in a different way than the presumption that affirmative action is going to help these kids. Affirmative action only helps a handful of people who are going to make it on their own generally as long as they do not encounter discrimination. So I want to thank you for allowing me to share a few thoughts with you and to visit with you about this subject. Thank you very much.
Let me introduce again now David Kramer.
First of all, I'll take a moment just to say thank you very much to everybody for coming today. I think there are a lot of very important issues on the ballot this fall, and for those of us who live here in Nebraska, this is a very important issue. I am, as Gary indicated, an attorney here in Omaha and someone who's been active in this community for nearly 30 years and active statewide, primarily in partisan politics. And so I know some people are a little surprised to see me here talking on the issue that I'm talking about today. But I think it's important to note that the organization that I'm involved with, Nebraskans United, is actually a very diverse coalition of Nebraskans who come from the business community, who come from the labor side of the equation, who come from education, who come from public policy advocacy groups. And we are all committed to the same thing, to ensuring that as a state, we continue to be a place where every one of our citizens can enjoy what we describe as the good life. And as I looked at, when I first was presented with the question related to this initiative of whether or not it made sense for Nebraska, I undertook it in a way which is the way I look at all of these kinds of initiative petitions. And I asked myself, what is it that's going on in Nebraska that is so significant and so troublesome that requires us to amend our Constitution? And I think we ought to remember that what we are doing is amending our state constitution. As a conservative, I am always skeptical of efforts to amend the Constitution. And frankly, I'm troubled by the fact that more and more, the first response to almost any issue is, let's go amend the Constitution. So let's look at, I think we should take a little bit of time here, and look at, and I think one of the things that's most instructive about what we've heard today and the message that as I evaluated this, this is a part of really a national effort. Nebraska, this is passed in three states. Initially, Mr. Connerly and his group, the American Civil Rights Initiative, targeted five states across the country, only two of which have succeeded in getting on the ballot, Nebraska and Colorado, and that the goal of this is to build momentum through passage at the state level for national activity. And as I looked at this proposal, I asked myself, and Mr. Connerly indicated it covers three particular areas: public employment, public education, and public contracting. And I asked myself, what is it that Nebraska is doing in those areas that runs afoul of the law? How is it that we're discriminating? What is it that necessitates this amendment of the Constitution? And the thing that I was most amazed by is that really we don't do much, if anything, in these areas, which has led me to describe this as a solution in search of a problem, at least with respect to the way things are here in the state of Nebraska. Now, Nebraska is very different than the way things were in California 10 or 12 years ago, the way they were in Michigan. But let's talk about Nebraska for a couple of minutes. First of all, let's focus on the issue of public contracting. Now, you may be surprised to learn that the state of Nebraska does not statutorily, as a state, have any preferences in public contracting except one. And that is, we give preferences as a state to in-state businesses versus out-of-state businesses, something that is not affected by this. Now, there are some state agencies that have the so-called minority or disadvantaged business enterprise systems, but all of those projects are mandated not by the state of Nebraska, but by federal law, federal contract, or federal legislation. which you'll find will be a central theme here, because this proposal specifically exempts those programs from being affected. Federal law will continue to apply here in Nebraska. Now, with respect to public employment, once again, let's look at what the state of Nebraska mandates. There is only one mandated preference by state statute for hiring, and that is to veterans over non-veterans, all other criteria being equal. Once again, veteran status not affected by this. Now, the state of Nebraska today has 22 affirmative action programs. Each agency has one. But those programs aren't mandated by the state of Nebraska. Once again, they're mandated by state, federal law, federal contract, federal grant, or federal legislation. And the result of that is should this pass on November 4th, the day after that, there will still be 22 affirmative action programs at the state level. And the area where this is going to impact the most is the area of public education. And I want to be clear about a couple of things with respect to public education. The University of Nebraska system is a land-grant college. As a land-grant college, every student who graduates from our high schools that meets the minimum academic requirements of the university is automatically admitted to the university, regardless of their race, regardless of their gender. And there are folks who say, but my son or daughter was denied admission to the university at undergraduate level because of these affirmative action, these equal opportunity programs. That is categorically and unequivocally not true. Now, with respect to our graduate programs, particularly the law school and the medical school, they have a competitive application process. And the University of Nebraska Law School has 40 different factors that they take into consideration. And in fact, there are factors like whether or not you speak multiple languages, whether or not you are from rural Nebraska. And perhaps those of us from Omaha, maybe we should be offended by the fact that somebody who's from rural Nebraska gets a benefit of that consideration in their application to the law school. 2 weeks ago, a group, albeit not Mr. Connolly's organization, but a group who came to advocate here in Nebraska that we should not that this should pass, asserted that the University of Nebraska Law School discriminates in its application process against whites because of the fact that and today, if we look at the actual numbers at the University of Nebraska Law School, in the first-year class, there are 6 African-American students. There are 6 black students. In the second-year law school class, there are 2 black students. In the third, there are 6. There are 14 black students at the University of Nebraska Law School, less than 4% of their enrollment, out of 400 students. And the interesting thing is, if you look at the applicant pool with African-Americans, Hispanics, Asians, and white students, the percentage of enrollment at the university, of admittance mirrors identically the percentage of students in the applicant pool. Each and every one of those students was qualified to gain admittance to the University of Nebraska Law School, and they were so admitted. And the interesting thing here, and this is critical, Mr. Connolly is absolutely right. The term affirmative action has changed dramatically over the last 30 years. And programs that were permissible under the law 30 years ago, quota programs. In fact, the University of California system had, in Bakke, I think they set aside 15% of the student population had to be minority students. Ruled unconstitutional by the courts. Set aside programs in contracting. Ruled unconstitutional by our courts. And the programs over the last 30 years have dramatically narrowed in their scope and in their application. The reason I make that point is because the kinds of things that I think a lot of people believe they're going to outlaw are already outlawed. And in fact, we don't do them here in the state of Nebraska. When I focus on what is the impact of 424 in Nebraska, I focus on what I describe, and I hope are, unintended consequences. It's the fact that at the University of Nebraska, for example, today, programs that are designed to encourage women to study science, mathematics, engineering, architecture, programs that historically women have not studied in, would be eliminated. Why? Because they're gender-based. They target women, and they incent them through scholarships and otherwise to study those kinds of programs. programs designed to encourage men through the use of scholarships to study elementary education so that we can get male teachers in the elementary classroom to serve as role models for our students would be gone. Why? Because they're gender-specific for men. We have scholarships at the University of Nebraska Law School that are privately funded scholarships administered by the university, like the Kinkella Scholarship. The Kinkella Scholarship is granted yearly to multiple women who have military service background. And Mrs. Kinkella was a woman who had military service, wanted to encourage other women to go to college. Gone. Why? Because it's gender specific. The Dobb Family Scholarship, which is our former mayor, Hal Dobb's family, they give scholarships to students from four particular counties in Nebraska who have German heritage. Gone, because it's national origin based. As I look at the question presented to us, which is should we amend our Constitution, I believe that the kinds of things that are going to be affected in practice in Nebraska, not in theory, not in California, not in Michigan, not in Washington State, but in actual practice here in Nebraska, that those things are things that most Nebraskans don't find objectionable. They're the kinds of things that I just described. If we had a dramatic pattern in a practice of setting aside spots for minority students or for female students, I think most Nebraskans that I know would be troubled by that. But we don't have that. Ladies and gentlemen, I think that, and I ask that you take a few minutes over the course of the next 2 weeks to discover what are the kinds of impacts that this has. There are many unintended consequences, and those unintended consequences, in my view, are not worth the risk of amending our Constitution. This language does some very creative things, not the least of which is it places in our Constitution a cause of action for people to sue. Very, very unusual that causes of action are actually inserted into the Constitution. In addition to that, I've noted previously that it does exempt the application of federal law and federal programs. And almost all of the programs that you hear about in the state of Nebraska related to minority and disadvantaged business enterprise programs, affirmative action, things like that, are done as a result of federal law. Given all of these factors, I want to encourage folks to vote no on 424. I look forward to the opportunity here, Gary, with Ward to answer some questions. Because I think that's usually the most informative part of these presentations. So I thank you very much, and I thank you for your consideration in taking this vote seriously.
Thank you very much. We're going to go to questions now, and I'll begin. What about changing the Constitution, Mr. Connerly? I mean, the Nebraska Constitution would be changed, and... Mr. Kramer said, you know, that shouldn't be done.
I respect the fact that the Constitution is a very important document in any state, certainly in our nation, and it should not be changed unless the proposed change goes through a very rigorous process. And indeed, this initiative has gone through that process. I would remind everyone that 172,000 people signed petitions to put this on the ballot. As far as I know, that's the only initiative that is on the ballot. And that suggests to me that people were, in fact, sufficiently convinced that this ought to be on the ballot and sign their names accordingly. I can't think of any right that is more fundamental to all of us in whatever state we reside than the right to be treated equally by our government. The Constitution is, in fact, the relationship. It's the document that establishes the relationship between the government and its people. And the right to equal treatment before the law, which is your motto, is something that, if anything, deserves to be in a Constitution. That creed certainly deserves to be there. So I have no problem with amending any constitution to say this is how I want my government to treat me. And that's all we're doing here.
Well, and if I could, Gary, the point that I'd like to make is that that statement presumes that today our government in Nebraska is not treating us fairly, that we as a state are discriminating. And frankly, I, as a Nebraskan, take great offense to the thought and to the proposition that somehow we are a bunch of folks who are discriminatory here in this state. And I think the evidence that I've talked a little bit about today, and if you take the time to research, demonstrates that we don't have the kinds of pervasive problems that may exist in other states, and that maybe you needed a constitutional amendment in California, but we certainly don't need one here in Nebraska.
David, I would commend to you page 25 of the Department of Motor Vehicles program regulations, employment selection process. Quote, once the applicant screening process is completed, selection is based upon A, training and experience in position for which they are applying, B, knowledge, skills, and ability, C, interview, D, protected groups and underutilization, E, references, F, seniority, where permanent state employees rate substantially the same. In the Nebraska Workforce Development Manual, page 34, goals and timetables. Goal 1, hire a minority and or disabled individual in the executive managerial category. Goal 2, hire an Hispanic individual in the professional category. Goal 3, hire 2 females in the paraprofessional category. Goal 4, hire 1 minority individual in the technical and or clerical category. All of these things suggest to me that the state government is, in fact, very race conscious. When you say we want to hire a, and then you fill in the blank in this category, that is the functional equivalent of a quota, my friend.
Well, first and foremost, they do not, a couple of things that I think need to be addressed here. To the extent that this were to pass on November the 4th, would that be any different the day after? No. And the reason why is because those programs at the DMV and other entities of the state are not state-mandated programs. They're in compliance with federal laws, federal mandates, federal contracts, and the receipt of federal grants. So that's the first point. The second point, I forgot my second point because I got so carried away with the first one. But I think it's critical to know that those factors are not as a result of any state-related mandate, but rather a federal one.
It's important, I think, for it's important for the public to know that my friend David is giving a rather liberal construction to that federal requirement. The language in the initiative honors the Federal Supremacy Clause. Obviously, the state of Nebraska cannot override the federal government. But the language is very precise that you can only invoke that federal clause if it's a condition of funding. If the federal government is requiring that you do something, that you give a preference as a condition of funding, yes, the Federal Supremacy Clause applies. The federal government doesn't require a preference. Nowhere does it require a preference.
And I remembered the second point. Thank you for helping me with that. I want to be clear about that. With respect to those state programs, there is no penalty, zero, none, for
nada.
Failure to meet those.
Nada.
Nada. And, sí, señor. There is no penalty for failure to meet those. They're not a quota because a quota would mean they've mandated that it be filled that way. It may be a goal that they have. It may be as a result of the federal guidelines that they're supposed to try to achieve diversity in those programs. But in the absence of a penalty for failure to achieve that, it's not a quota. And it's very different than a quota, which at least historically, and the courts have ruled is illegal. And to make the final decision based on race, based on gender, is illegal today. It is illegal today. And under the very laws that you've talked about that we have at the national level.
So is murder, but it still happens.
I'm going to go on to another question.
And changing the Constitution won't stop it.
And David, this is for you specifically. Has Judge Karen Thomas made a verdict on Nebraskans United lawsuit regarding the validity of petition signatures?
It's actually Karen Flowers in Lancaster County District Court Judge, and actually this is a great question. The answer to that question is no, but I think folks ought to be, we should just want to share with folks what the substance of that lawsuit is. Mr. Connerly indicated that 172,000 signatures were gathered and that that is validation enough. Nebraska law has some not terribly stringent in comparison to other states, minimum requirements of what has to be done in order to get your petition on the ballot. And the folks, I don't think it's so much the folks at Nebraska Civil Rights Initiative or Mr. Connerly, but the folks that they hired, and so it is a reflection on them, National Ballot Access, who came to our state and blatantly disregarded our law. We had testimony from their own circulators at trial that said that despite the fact that they were supposed to read the object statement to every citizen, that one circulator testified that out of the 5,000 that he collected, less than 100 times did he read the object statement. We had testimony at the trial and affidavits that we provided to the Secretary of State that said, look, there were people who were using in Lincoln the state fair petition saying sign the state fair when what it was the Civil Rights Initiative petition, that circulators were saying to people, hey, how would you like to end discrimination in Nebraska? Well, who wouldn't be against that? So what we've challenged in Lincoln is whether or not in the gathering of petition signatures the law of Nebraska was followed. And I expect all Nebraskans and those from other states who come here, whether at the request of Nebraskans or not, to respect our laws, and that's the object of that lawsuit.
Mr. Connery?
It's up to Judge Flowers to decide whether Mr. Kramer is right or wrong, and we expect a decision momentarily on that point. And then it leaves the political arena, and it becomes a matter of law, one way or the other. But that's for the judge to decide.
David Kramer, how does your position that we have no problems in Nebraska relate to the case of the Omaha Fire Department's reverse discrimination case that cost the city of Omaha $130,000? Two white firemen were overlooked for promotion based upon the color of their skin.
And actually, I think that is a fantastic example of why we don't need a constitutional amendment to fix problems here in Nebraska. That lawsuit resulted in what happening? A complete change in the promotion system at the city of Omaha. So that today, the processes that were inappropriate and identified by the court as inappropriate don't exist anymore. We didn't need a constitutional amendment to fix it. A simple lawsuit did. And so, yes, the city paid a judgment. And the problem that the city of Omaha had was that they were offering to promote people who didn't pass, there was a minimum qualifications test, and that people who were outside of meeting the minimum qualifications, if they were minority or women, could still be considered for promotion. I agree that that's wrong. And so the city of Omaha changed that. We didn't need a constitutional amendment to do it.
David, what about the protected group program in the city of Omaha that Matt Hansen of the Omaha World Herald wrote about
2 weeks ago?
Yeah, that's not a solution in search of a problem, is
well,
it?
Well, actually, it is, because the interesting thing with respect to, and this is the issue of public contracting by the city of Omaha, the issue there isn't that you have to if you don't meet the goals for minority contractors, that you don't get the bid. That isn't the case. And in fact, in the history of that program, as I understand it from the city, there were only two occasions when that's happened. That what a contractor has the right to do is to say, look, I made a good faith effort to try and get as broad a group of folks in here, and if you make the good faith effort, you can get the contract if you're the lowest bid. So it isn't a quota system. It isn't that the decision is made by the city that you get it. And I'll tell you, you've heard me say, I've actually represented clients. I'm a management side labor lawyer, represented clients in the bidding process before the city of Omaha, and I have a pretty good understanding of it. And we've represented them, and they've gotten the contracts despite the fact that they didn't meet the goals that the city had identified for minority for minority subcontractors.
That does not, and you're an honorable man, but that does not square with the information that I received from about seven contractors who have had to participate in that program who say it's a nightmare. So,
well, I'll go back to my earlier point. As my understanding, in the 20-some years that program has been before the city of Omaha, there has never been an effort to try and get the city council to change it. And so I would suggest that perhaps, rather than start in the state constitution, that maybe, and, you know, if this is a Republican-Democrat issue, which some people say it is, hey, we've got a majority control of the city council. Why isn't that they haven't changed it? I don't think it's a partisan issue. I think that if you want to, you know, in my view, if you've got a narrow problem, let's start with a narrow solution. And the state constitutional amendment brings with it many other implications that we don't know today, that we will only sort through litigation, as they have done in other states.
You should love that.
Pardon? Well, absolutely. As a lawyer, I'd love it. Is it good for us in Nebraska? No, it's not.
Mr. Connerly.
Yes.
You are a resident of California, and most of your funding is from outstate funding to promote the Nebraska program. I think this means the Nebraska Initiative. Why do you and your backers feel you need to tell us to amend our Constitution?
I'm not telling you anything, folks. The Nebraska Association of Scholars about 10 years ago approached me to come here. I could not at the time. We're here now. We're bringing those who believe in this nationwide, bringing their support here. Our opponents have nationwide national support as well. And any public policy issue, there will be people outside your borders who will weigh in. But I'm not trying to tell you what to do. You've invited me here today, for example, to ask for my opinion. You can take it or leave it, and I'm giving it. But I'm not intruding in your domain. This is a great state, but you do not live alone, and especially when it comes to race. This is a national issue. And when it comes to race, a lot of people will feel inclined to say, if you want my opinion, I will give it. And that's all I'm doing. It won't take much for me to jump on the plane and fly back. If I'm not wanted, I'm out of here. But I have been invited to be here. Pete Ricketts and a number of others on occasion have said, give us your advice on it.
And we're thrilled to have you here spending your money. We're always happy to take that. But the point that I want to make, and I want to be clear about what Nebraskans United's criticism of the Nebraska Civil Rights Initiative has been, and that is that it isn't that they took money from out of state, and you're absolutely right. We have, I think to date, one $25,000 contribution out of the $400,000 that we've raised from out of state. The point that I've made repeatedly is that 90-plus percent of the contributions that have funded this effort have come from outside of the state of Nebraska, that at least on the reports that I've seen to date, there are two donors to this effort in the state of Nebraska. And that I think it's important for folks to understand who's supporting and who's behind it. And we've been very, very public in disclosing every single one of who our donors are. As for the Nebraska Association of Scholars, let me take one step back from that. First of all, I'll bet you that nobody in this room 10 months ago thought that this was the most pressing issue that we ought to get on the ballot and have to decide at this election this fall. It wasn't. And the only reason it was, and you've taken issue with the fact that we spent $400,000 to try to keep it off the ballot without acknowledging that you spent nearly $800,000 to get it on the ballot, utilizing paid circulators primarily as the people who got that, is that the Nebraska Association of Scholars actually is, there may be more of them, but there are three professors at the University of Nebraska who, and they testified at a public hearing before the Secretary of State a week ago, or 2 weeks ago, who were unhappy with initially a program that the university instructed them in the chemistry department to explore hiring of minority candidates, which was 12 or 13 years ago. The laws in this country, the Supreme Court itself has significantly narrowed what the programs are permissible in that regard. And in fact, Nebraska's application process has changed fairly dramatically over that time. And while the Nebraska Association of Scholars may have invited you to come here, and you've come today at the request of the Press Club or whoever, the fact remains that this issue is not being driven by Nebraskans. It's being driven by folks from out of state. And I'll refer, we just mentioned the fact that there was a trial that went 3 weeks ago. There was email correspondence disclosed at that trial from your folks to Mr. Snyderjans, the head of the Nebraska Association of Scholars, saying, do not communicate with the press or in public. That's Mr. Connerly's responsibility. So, you know, they may have invited you here, but this is an effort that comes with a national.
I'd sure like to see that email.
Well, I'm happy to. Actually, your lawyers have it, and your Mr. Teets and others, and they have that already because they disclosed it to us. So, you know, you can have that discussion with them, and if they won't give it to you, I'll be happy to share.
I'd love to have it. You know, the issue is not all of this extraneous stuff that Mr. Kramer or I are bringing up. The thing that's on your ballot are the 37 words and whether you believe it's an appropriate policy or not. The state shall not discriminate against or grant preferential treatment to any individual or group on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin in the operation of public employment, public education, or public contracting. If that is consistent with your motto of equality before the law and you want to live out the true meaning of your creed, there's nothing wrong with that being in your Constitution. That is, as I've said before, the most fundamental edict that there is of any people and their relationship to their government. Everything else that we're talking about here of who gave how much money, and I could talk about the fact that this is an historic amount of money to be contributed to keep an initiative off the ballot, but that's irrelevant to the basic question of whether you support that language or not. And in every campaign, there are those, primarily in the establishment, who say that there are all these things that are wrong about the process. But the fact remains that when the people have a chance to vote on it, overwhelmingly, they agree with that principle of equality for everybody, regardless of race. And that is the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
And I want to be unequivocal about something. I don't have any issue with having the right for us to vote on something if people did follow the process. Because in my view, process matters. That's what laws are for. We expect people to respect the law. But in addition to the process, words matter. And I'll give you credit. I don't know who it was, if it was you who came up with it, who it was. The language is fantastic, folks. The language is fantastic. You know, the question, Mr. Connerly has asked the question when he repeats those words, who could possibly be against this? Well, I am. So at least one of us is here in Nebraska, and I look at, because words have meaning. It isn't the simple words on the paper that matter. It's how those words ultimately are going to be implemented and impact each and every one of us. You know, and I know that courts all across this land find all sorts of things, not just in the words anymore, but in the penumbra of the words. And I am always, always cautious about putting into our Constitution, for the first time, new rights and responsibilities when I believe we have all of the safeguards necessary. Why should we give a judge or a court the opportunity to interpret the question of what does shall not discriminate on the basis of sex mean? Does it apply to other things? Does it apply? You and I talked off air yesterday during one of the breaks on one of the things about adoption in Nebraska and potential impacts there. With Mr. Asher from Missouri, who ran the operation from Missouri, we've talked about the potential that it has on marriage. Why take the risk? Why take the risk?
Couple of questions here with regard to what has happened in other states. Mr. Connerly, I'm not sure where this has been passed before, but can you give us a sense of that and what has happened in those states?
It's passed in the state of California, 55-45%. In the immediate aftermath of its passage, the number of black students and Latinos plummeted at the University of California at Berkeley and UCLA. The reason is that there is a profound academic gap between what we called underrepresented minorities, black, Native American, and Latino, and Asians and whites. That is a national gap. And therefore, once we started applying scholastic standards for admission to a scholastic institution, that gap began to manifest itself. And as a result of that, the university, at my behest, went from a race-based system to one in which we looked at how we can better prepare our kids. We entered into a contract with 150 of the worst-performing schools in California. The University of California has contracts with them in which if you do these things, your kids will be automatically admitted. We have contracts with our community colleges and high schools to get them prepared. We have more mentoring, more tutoring, more after-school programs that are now available. So we're doing the heavy lifting that's required to get these kids prepared. You know, if you look around your state and you look at Omaha and you look at other places where there are heavy concentrations of minority kids, ask yourself this question. Are we doing any better in getting those kids prepared now than we were 40 years ago? I don't think so. Kids are dropping out now out of the ninth grade at 40, 50% levels. What we need to be doing is focusing in a different way on how to get those kids prepared so that they can lead productive lives. Not every kid has to go to college, but we certainly want them prepared to lead a productive life. And so I think that the way we have been going with race-based decision-making is not only fraught with resentment and a lot of other consequences, but it's not working. It's just not doing the job. And the courts have also said that a lot of the rationale for these programs, leveling the playing field and all of that, and you'll hear people say, well, we're not there yet. A lot of that is not even permitted by the courts. In 2003, the courts really outlawed this argument about leveling the playing field. The only permissible use of race is diversity. That's the only permissible use. A lot of these other things that we have in mind, the courts have outlawed that a long time ago.
Let me address a couple of things. Actually, there's just a new report out of Michigan, which is the most recent state to pass it, about the impact in the last 2 years on the enrollment at the University of Michigan, which is the flagship university system of the state system, and minority enrollment of two categories. Hispanics and African Americans are down 8% already in 2 years. They dropped 30%, I think, in California initially, or maybe it was actually 30% of previous enrollment. That's since bounced up, but let me clarify one thing about the bounce in California. In 1996, minority enrollment in high schools in California accounted for about 33% of the high school graduates. Today, it accounts for 48.5%. And we still have not, in 12 years, reached the percentage of minority students of Hispanic and African American, those two categories in particular, have not reached even the levels where they were pre-1996. So it does have a profound impact. As I indicated, it has a tremendous impact on us. Primarily in Nebraska, the impact, I think, will be felt through the university system. But I do want to address one thing. Mr. Connerly and I are in agreement. We've had this discussion before on the education and the fact that a gap exists. And I think there are questions of what are we going to do until the discussion about what we should do, elementary education, and in case you haven't had the opportunity, we have one of the most amazing early childhood development programs going on here in Omaha that is becoming a national model. I would encourage you to take a look at that. But that's going to take 12, 15 years, 20 years to filter through the system. And in the meantime, what are we going to do about all those kids who have the achievement gap?
Well, the problem of the achievement gap is one that we have to address, and I don't think that we solve it by applying different standards to kids. I think it requires tough love. It requires the discipline to make sure that kids study. I mean, kids come here from all around the globe to our colleges here. Many of them don't even speak English, but they learn the process of learning. And we have to do that here with our own kids, black and Latino kids. The solution, it seems to me, is not to give them a preference, not to apply a different standard to them, because if we want those kids and we believe that they can compete, we have to insist that they do so. And I think that early childhood education, after-school programs, better teachers, all of those things are essential to helping these kids to do better in school.
David, you talked about unintended consequences, and I've got two, three questions here. Questioners want to know, what are you talking about, and is this, are these unintended consequences something we really have to be worried about?
Well, I've mentioned the specific examples of programs that I've talked about that would be eliminated. In my view, and maybe I'm wrong, that those are exactly what they want to eliminate. Those, in my view, are the unintended consequences, that the programs for encouraging students or men to do elementary education, the kinds of scholarships. I've only mentioned two scholarships, but there's probably 80 scholarships, and I don't mean 80 individuals, but 80 types of scholarships that the university currently has that would be affected by this, most of which I don't think Nebraskans would find to be objectionable. I also mentioned that I think there will be, should this pass, there will be significant litigation on the question of whether or not this impacts things like adoptions in Nebraska, which Nebraska has a recent Supreme Court case on who can and can't adopt. It will revisit the question of marriage, that the Defense of Marriage Act that came up, and the benefits that are provided at the university system to same-sex couples or not to same-sex couples. And I think you'll see some significant litigation on that. And the question to me is, I can't tell you how that's going to come out. I can't say it's going to go one way or another. But the question is given what the climate is today and the issues that we've faced as a state and what the problems are, do we need to open the door to all of those kinds of unintended consequences, or do we even need that?
Red herring, the reddest of red herrings. This affects public employment, public education, and public contracting. That's all. That's all it affects. And while we don't want to model your state after some other state, there is an abundance of law on this already. This ground has already been plowed in California and Washington and Michigan, and we've talked to the Defense of Marriage people and others about, does this apply to adoptions or whatever? And most of them giggle when you raise that, because it doesn't apply.
Well, in the state of Nebraska, I don't know what other courts in other states have done, but the state of Nebraska has said that you mentioned public contracting, public employment, that a marriage certificate, marriage license in this state, an adoption certificate is actually a public contract. And so there's the opportunity for a court to apply this because it applies in that arena. You and I were talking yesterday about the question of employee benefits. Public employment doesn't just include whether you get a job or not. It includes all of the employee benefits that you award people and whether or not those benefits are based on you discriminate against, or in this instance provide preferential treatment to one. Then we'll just focus on the word sex, which is the word that's in the act. I think it opens questions for lots of creative legal arguments, and I don't think it's a risk worth taking.
Never, you'll never hear it from me that attorneys can't be creative. I've got invoices coming out the yin-yang of attorneys and their creativity. But nobody has to fear anything about these hidden consequences. I could show you the campaign record in Michigan and California and Washington State, and when people can't argue against the notion of not using preferential treatment, they bring out that canard about hidden unintended consequences. Yes, it is going to eliminate race or gender exclusive scholarships. Yes, we're admitting that. We're saying, yes, if you're administering a contract or a scholarship, rather, that is restricted to whites or blacks or anybody else, that is going to be eliminated. But if you want those scholarships to continue, and it's private money, do it through a nonprofit. Make the scholarship available yourself. You don't have to go through the government in order to do that. Well, and with respect to programs that encourage women to go into math and science, there's nothing that prevents the university from saying, on Saturday we're going to invite women to the school to talk about scholarships or talk about programs in math and science, or we're going to invite men to the school to talk about nursing for men?
Well, sure it does, because they have to pay for that somehow, and they've distinguished that they're inviting only women. I'm inviting women to come on Saturday. That's discriminatory against men. You know, it's the we've talked about the breast cancer screening too, which is the issue there is there's breast cancer screening today in California, no question about it. But you know what? Men are eligible for breast cancer screening too now. And I'm not saying that men don't get it, but it's the we now have to be politically correct. Nobody wants to talk about in order to get the program done.
It's not political correctness, my friend. If there is public money, taxpayer money available, and a man wants to go in for breast cancer screening, and believe me, men do have, breast cancer, then they should be allowed to do that if it's public tax money involved.
Last question. I think that at the basic core of evaluation of this initiative, this action, this initiative, promotes racism, sexism, etc.
To believe that, one would have to believe that the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which gave me the right to be treated equally by my government, promotes racism. The Act says that no one shall be treated differently because of race, gender, national origin, or national ancestry. How in the world can it be that an initiative which says the government will not discriminate against or grant preferential treatment to anyone promotes racism? Only George Orwell would believe such a notion.
David?
I don't think that it promotes racism or sexism, but I think it falsely deludes us into believing that somehow we are at a point in time where those factors don't matter. And, I mean, we've heard discussion of it today. Mr. Connolly, I think you'll agree that people give you credibility on this issue, not just because of your experience, but because of the fact that you are an African-American man, a black man. And whether that should be true or not, whether it's great or not, is not relevant, I think, at this point in time. The reality is that we are judging people by their skin color. We do make judgments about them based on their gender. And the question is whether or not the kind of specific conduct that we're actually talking about in the state of Nebraska, I'm not talking about California and place else, what it is we do in Nebraska is inappropriate. I don't believe it is, which is why I vote against this. Mr. Connerly believes that it is, which is why he supports it. I don't think inherently the language is designed to be racist, and I wouldn't ascribe that position to the proponents of it.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. We've heard a debate on the topic, should affirmative action in Nebraska be banned? The participants were Ward Connerly, representing the Nebraska Civil Rights Initiative, and David Kramer, representing Nebraskans United. They have debated a proposed constitutional amendment that voters will decide in the November 4th election. The proposal would bar public agencies, such as local governments, as well as the University of Nebraska, from considering race and gender when awarding scholarships, hiring employees, or contracting for construction work. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, October 22nd, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next forum will be held Thursday, November 20th at 12 noon. The topic, Global Warming, Pro and Con, will be discussed by Bruce Johansson, a communications professor at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and Robert Smith, a professor of chemistry at UNO. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete noon forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.